This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes.
What I've said is we will take every bit of help that we can get, every bit of help that we can get, if it means accelerating the process by which people get their power restored.
While battling Florida's first hurricane in more than a decade, Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum gets caught in a political storm of his own.
The criticism started to focus on city-owned utilities versus for-profit utilities. That's a food fight that has been around a long time. And it's extremely political.
Times Union Capital Bureau Chief Tia Mitchell explores the politics behind Hermine. Meanwhile, there appears to be one storm that refuses to downgrade for Attorney General Pam Bondi.
The foundation making a political contribution to the Florida Attorney General, who was just about to investigate Trump University, and then ending the investigation.
And we'll dive deep into the science behind the outbreaks of red tide and algae blooms in Florida waters.
600% higher phosphorus in the North Fork of that estuary than the water coming in from Lake Okeechobee. And this is what really stimulated those thick guacamole-like blooms that you saw in the media.
All that and more coming up on episode 75 of The Rotunda. You're listening to the remnants of Hermine, just hours after it made landfall as a Category 1 hurricane just south of Tallahassee. With sustained winds of 80 miles per hour, Hermine caused flooding and property damage throughout the Panhandle and other parts of Florida.
This is Intersection. I'm Crystal Chavez, filling in for Matthew Petty.
Once again, the nation was fixated on the Sunshine State as the first hurricane in a long time barreled towards the capital. But soon after Hermine made landfall and began losing power, another storm started brewing.
Hurricane Hermine spared Central Florida but left tens of thousands of people in Tallahassee without electricity. And local politicians, the governor, and power companies are sparring over the recovery response.
And many wanted to know just what was going on in Florida's capital city. Here's my cameo on Orlando's public radio station, WMFE.
And joining us from Tallahassee, Tramell Gomes, host of the Rotunda podcast. First off, Tramell, how long was your power off up there in Tallahassee?
Well, I am sorry I couldn't join you guys last week due to the power outage. But thankfully for me, it was only about 26 to 27 hours without power. I think as you guys have seen, things appear to be a much bigger storm politically than what was actually on the ground here in Tallahassee.
And let me make it clear as to not discount the significant damage caused by the storm, especially for those who suffered from trees falling in their roofs and damaged vehicles. But some of the complaints by Tallahassee's politically connected went viral really fast. And it was just a mere few hours after the brunt of the storm. To help further break down the politics of it all is a returning guest from the Times Union Capital Bureau.
Tia Mitchell, welcome to the Rotunda. Glad to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been observing, just like I have been, Hermine, and not just the storm that came through Tallahassee and the outage that it caused, like, I don't know, some 90,000 or people without power, including both of us, I guess, ourselves.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. For me, it was 26 hours. What about you?
I left town on Friday, and when I got back on Monday, the power was back on, so I escaped.
Well, coming back and even being here, because I stayed throughout, the storm was not the storm itself. It just grew into something else politically, especially on social media. What were you seeing?
Even though I escaped to Atlanta, I was monitoring my social media and checking Facebook and Twitter. And it was Saturday evening when I first started seeing complaints about Mayor Gillum, particularly. It wasn't just complaints about the city recovery. They were specifically complaining about Mayor Gillum's leadership. And I engaged some of those folks on Twitter particularly and just said, you know, within 48 hours, what is the exact concern. And I said then, that was Saturday, and I said, it just looks like some of the people and some of the criticism might be more politically motivated than just storm concerns.
Mm-hmm. I saw that too. Particularly, I follow, like, you know, all sides, all parties, all of the party websites and social media pages, and especially the Leon County Republican Facebook page, and some of the words that were being used and calling out the mayor, like, immediately after. And I was even receiving texts from people asking, did you hear about the mayor or the city officials rejecting money? I was like, no, where did that come from? So it was stirring in with among people before it even hit social media.
Right. I mean, and there was a lot of rumors, a lot of innuendo, you know, and it was a lot of, like, for example, City of Tallahassee said they got more help offered than they could accept. Now, you could say, well, that means they were rejecting help. But that's just the way, you know, it's the words you use and words matter. So someone, you know, so that's just an example of how both sides were kind of talking across each other. And my concern all along was not so much the political folks can handle themselves. Mayor Gillum, he's been in politics for a long time. He wants to remain in politics for a long time. He can handle the criticism. But we saw how when he started to get defensive, then he and Governor Scott weren't working so well together.
The idea that we would take a, I don't know if it's a tweet or a rumor, and suggest that our call center folks are not doing their jobs. These are the same people that we've all been in the same room with since Thursday. Staff by volunteers and hard workers who have themselves, in spite of not having power, at their homes.
I've never suggested somebody wasn't doing a good job. What I've suggested, let me just finish for a second. What I suggested is, if you would just look at your process, okay, to make sure it's easy for people to get, make sure they're talking to a live person, because people are complaining to me. I could be completely wrong, because everything I get is second, third, and fourth hand.
That breakdown has impact on the recovery if the people who are out front can't get along. And so, you know, we all wanted people's power to be on, and especially at hospitals and nursing homes. Well, the politics, whatever side you're on, the politics don't help that.
Mm-hmm. I actually saw the breakdown. Like, even Mayor Gillum at the beginning was praising the calls and citing, oh, I just got off the phone with Governor Scott, and as he was checking in on the recovery efforts, everyone was getting along, and then the politics, the complaints injected into it, and then they can't even sit at the EOC.
Now everyone's defensive, and that's natural. And that, when I first on Saturday saw the attacks of Mayor Gillum, I knew eventually he would get defensive. It's a natural response when you feel attacked, especially if you feel, as he said, that he felt it was unjust. Mm-hmm. And then you get defensive, you start not trusting, especially across party lines. And Gillum is a Democrat. Tallahassee is a kind of a Democratic city, and the state government is Republican controlled. So if there's no trust between those folks and it starts breaking down along partisan lines, then again, that impedes the recovery effort. And that was my concern when I wrote my column. It's like, let's look at how the recovery effort got kind of wrapped up in politics that is kind of not with people's power getting cut on.
Well, one of the things that stood out in your column was the swift action to the legislative level. And we're seeing some of these issues that were coming out of this storm that will be addressed in session. What did you make of that end of the political motivation? Did that send some insight in any way?
Right. And we'll see exactly, you know, the session, you know, they'll start back up in November, you know, reorganizing and committees in December, session in March. So we'll see after a couple of months, are people as riled up about Hermine as they are now? You saw some state legislators thinking that was an issue that possibly, you know, they could get behind, kind of a populist thing, because there was a lot of people. As the days wore on and power wasn't being restored, people were justifiably more concerned. And the power companies, you could tell a lot of the criticism started to focus on city-owned utilities versus for-profit utilities. That's a food fight that has been around a long time. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely political. So even just one investor-owned, which is what they call the for-profit, the investor-owned utilities saying, well, we could have done that better. I'm not saying they don't believe it's true. I'm sure they believe they could have done it better. But that's also a calculated political statement many times, because there is such a food fight between the two.
From knowing where we know now, seeing, like, you know, the organization of it all, where FPL was brought in to the at the table to have this discussion and force Mayor Gillum to really face FPL CEO, and to see it picked up by Senator Jack Latvala, and all of it in the end to really force an action where there was probably no action going forward.
You know, I am not going to question the governor's decision to bring in Florida Power and Light. However, I will say that things don't happen in a vacuum in politics ever. There's calculation, and I'm not saying this in a negative way, but political people are always, you know, thinking about what they say, when they say it, how they say it. So I just think, you know, as I said way back last Saturday, 2 days after the storm, people just need to pay attention and understand at least the players. Then they can make their own decisions, you know, and I'm talking about the greater public, the voters. You know, the voters need to understand that Florida Power and Light is an investor-owned utility. Other investor-owned utilities have had concerns about the municipal utilities. Mary Ellen Klass from Miami Herald did an article about investor-owned utilities wanting to buy up municipal utilities. Mm-hmm. So understand that context. So when investor-owned utilities criticize or find fault with city-owned utilities, you can understand a little bit more of maybe some of the background of those mm-hmm. complaints. And the same can go vice versa. You know, municipal-owned utilities have resisted oversight from the Florida PSC. They don't pay taxes because they're public-owned, mm-hmm. you know, and that's a sore spot for some folks. And so when they defend themselves or say, you know, understand the context, mm-hmm. that's always important.
Any other takeaways from this, and what's next out of the Hermine saga?
I do think the city of Tallahassee is in recovery. Most people have their lights back, and I do think people are already moving on. Mm-hmm. It'll just be interesting to see, again, when the legislature reorganizes, is Hermine still going to be on their brain?
Yeah. All right. Well, Tia Mitchell, thank you for taking this time to speak with me. I look forward to seeing how this unfolds when session comes back around.
Thank you.
That's Tia Mitchell with the Times Union. This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes. During the program, we will hear from a couple of top scientists ready to break down the facts behind red tide and algae blooms. But first, Attorney General Pam Bondi is back in the national spotlight for about the third time for the same story. Her connection to Donald Trump.
I've just known Pam Bondi for years. I have a lot of respect for her. Never spoke to her about that at all. And just have a lot of respect for her.
Trump was forced to pay a fine to the IRS for giving Bondi a campaign contribution through his charity foundation, which is under scrutiny. Trump has always been very vocal about donating to politicians in exchange for favors. But now he's saying everything was done above board, but Hillary Clinton is seizing on the opportunity.
I am quite taken aback by the foundation making a political contribution to the Florida Attorney General, who is just about to investigate Trump University and then ending the investigation.
Now, Clinton made those comments just before she went into a coughing fit on her plane. Now, with her being diagnosed with pneumonia, at least that's what we know so far, that news will dominate the news cycle this week. You're listening to The Rotunda, a podcast about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. This program is made possible thanks to listeners like you. Please visit rotundapodcast.com to learn more about underwriting opportunities. You can sponsor this program or make a donation at the top right of rotundapodcast.com. Thanks for your support. It's been a very busy summer. Florida has been in the national spotlight for what seemed to be every other week. But one was particularly putrid, turning away many from Florida's often pristine lakes, rivers, springs, and beaches.
Just as millions of Americans prepare to get some sand and sun this 4th of July weekend, Florida's governor has declared a state of emergency over a massive invasion of toxic algae in communities and beaches along Florida's
rivers and beaches coated in toxic blue-green algae. The stench forcing some to wear masks.
It's awful. It really is.
But what caused all of the green goo that dominated all of the smelly headlines? We've assembled two experts to focus on the facts behind red tide and algal blooms. It's a roundtable-esque discussion. First, you'll hear from...
My name's Brian LaPointe, and I work with the Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute in Fort Pierce, Florida. We're part of Florida Atlantic University. And I've been studying water quality and harmful algal blooms around the state of Florida for over three decades.
And then...
My name is Vince Lovko. I'm a research scientist and the phytoplankton ecology program manager at Moat Marine Lab. I've not been studying harmful algae for quite that long, but I think I'm over a decade now if I include grad school. Not all Florida, though.
They're both joining the program virtually. Dr. Brian LaPointe is plugging in while on a trip in Maine, and Dr. Vincent Lovko is in Sarasota, and I'm in Tallahassee, moderating and bringing it all together right here on The Rotunda.
It's great. Great to meet you again. We probably have met. I've been a big fan of Moat over the years. I knew Kumar, Richard Pierce, I've known for many, many, many years. So
yeah, we have a great group here for sure.
Oh, good. Well, I like doing this program. My background is covering Florida's environment. And Florida's environment has been in the news, national news lately, especially over this summer. So I just wanted to give our audience a chance to get the real deep down story from experts like you to really grasp and understand what's going on. So let's start with the basic. What is red tide? Dr. Lovko, since that's the bulk of your research, what is red tide?
Red tide, it's a common name and somewhat of a misnomer, but even us scientists and researchers still use it. But it's really refers to harmful algal blooms. And harmful algal blooms, or HABs, as they're often referred to, is a much broader phenomena that includes a number of different groups of microalgae, of small photosynthetic, usually single-celled, sometimes chain-forming or colonial microorganisms that can form blooms. And these blooms can be harmful through a variety of ways. One of the most common ways that when we refer to HABs is we're talking about toxin-producing. Now, when we talk about red tide, it's a misnomer. The water does not always turn red, and it has nothing to do with the tide. But like I said, it's a term that is stuck. But when we talk about red tide, we're often talking about dinoflagellate blooms. Those are the ones that would tend to color the water red more often than not. And here in Florida, when we talk about Florida red tide, we're talking about a very specific species, Karenia brevis. And that occurs not only in Florida and not always only on the Gulf Coast, but for the most part, it's most common on the West Florida shelf here in Florida, also on the other side of the Gulf in Texas. And it's caused by a dinoflagellate called Karenia brevis. Uh-huh. So as far as what is red tide, that is what red tide is in a broad and narrow sense.
All right.
Perhaps Brian can add some to that.
And I understand it's not just red. There's a variety, Dr. LaPointe?
Yeah. Oh, that was a great intro to the West Coast red tides. And, you know, I first got to work on red tides and related harmful algal blooms, what we call red drift macroalgae, which are seaweeds. And these macroalgae aren't toxic like the red tide organism, Karenia brevis, but they can cause harm to the environment, the coastal environment, and also to the economy. In 2003 and 2004, I was working with Lee County government, and we saw for the first time these big macroalgae blooms. These are red seaweeds that were growing in the coastal zone and were washing up on the beaches several feet thick, covering the beaches at Sanibel, Bonita Springs, a lot of the beaches in Lee County, and scaring the tourists away. They would rot and stink on the beach. And we actually include these macroalgae blooms like this. Even though they're not toxic, we include them within the umbrella term harmful algal blooms because the causes and effects of these are very similar in many ways to the toxic phytoplankton blooms like red tides.
So when we hear harmful algal blooms, like how harmful can it be? What kind of harm could they impart on us humans?
The harmful effects can be very broad, like Brian was saying. They can include those ecological effects as well as, you know, toxic effects. You know, it can have just a large biomass that can wash up on the beach and rot, that can fall at the bottom and cause dissolved oxygen problems. So the harmful effect can be quite broad. And I think at some point in the past, there was a consideration to call them ecological disruptive blooms. But when we do talk about the toxic blooms, which that is not the only form of harm, but that is one of the ones that we have a lot of concern about, especially here on the west coast of Florida, they are toxins, and there's different harmful algal blooms caused by dinoflagellates around the world, and some of those produce different kinds of toxins. The toxin produced by Karenia brevis, our Florida red tide organism, is a brevetoxin, and it's a neurotoxin. So that basically, you know, to be simple about it, it disrupts the functioning of the nerves. And so that can cause a variety of problems in humans. It can cause respiratory irritation and distress. It can kill marine wildlife, fish, and even mammals and birds. And often when the mammals or birds are affected, it's because they've been eating fish or in other way ingesting the toxin.
So when we look over back to the summer that we've had here in Florida, what are some of the causes of what we've seen over the summer? And if you can bring us up to speed, Dr. LaPointe.
Well, most of the action was in the St. Lucie Estuary and the Indian River Lagoon system. And just a little background on this area. This Indian River Lagoon is about 156 miles long. It extends from New Smyrna Beach in the north, south all the way to Jupiter, Florida. And this is an area I've been working in since about 2011. And we've seen, in that time period, we've seen a worsening of water quality problems, phytoplankton blooms. It began with a super bloom in 2011 up in the northern Indian River Lagoon, followed by a brown tide. This is a different type of organism than the red tide. It colors the water brown like a cup of coffee. And it blocks the light. And so when we had these blooms develop in 2011, 2012, we began to see a major seagrass decline in the Indian River Lagoon due to the decreased light. And what happened following that, we began to see problems in manatees in that area. The manatees that normally feed on the seagrasses were switching their diet and feeding on macroalgae. And I had previously mentioned these blooms of macroalgae in Lee County. We have very similar blooms in the Indian River Lagoon. And the manatees were eating a lot of this macroalgae, I mean, 50, 80 pounds a day. And they were being found dead, I think, in 2013, when this all began to culminate. And as Vincent knows, this is a problem with the red tide, with manatees, a very similar problem. So this was the first time we saw, you know, an endangered species, a manatee, being affected like this in the Indian River Lagoon. So that's the northern Indian River Lagoon. That's kind of the run-up to what happened this summer. So we've been having these these harmful algal bloom events over the past few years. And in 2013, we did have some major water releases from Lake Okeechobee to the St. Lucie estuary. We had what we kind of call this toxic blue-green algae bloom, Microcystis. We saw some of that bloom form, and this coincided again with our research we were doing in the lagoon. And we saw this happen to a much larger extent this past summer. With all the rainfall we had this past winter on the Kissimmee River watershed and the spring, okay, we had a lot of water coming into Lake Okeechobee. That water was released to the St. Lucie and Caloosahatchee estuaries. And this is what basically brought this seed organism. It's a freshwater blue-green alga, Microcystis. It does produce toxins, microcystins. And this is what came into the estuary. But what our research shows is once this organism actually got in to the St. Lucie estuary, it encountered very high nutrient concentrations, 600% higher phosphorus in the North Fork of that estuary than the water coming in from Lake Okeechobee. And this is what really stimulated those thick guacamole-like blooms that you saw in the media, on television and in the newspapers that were reporting on these blooms. It was very disruptive to, as you can imagine, to the economy in that region this summer. Fishing, swimming, diving activities were curtailed, and a number of beaches and areas shut down because of the toxicity associated with that bloom.
So what are the causes, and feel free to chime in, Dr. Lufko, what's natural and what's unnatural in what we saw over the summer?
Well, I would say we saw unusually large amounts of rainfall as a run-up to this problem, okay, that brought not just water in the Lake Okeechobee, but a lot of nutrients. And most of those nutrients in water, more than 90%, came from north of Lake Okeechobee. That watershed extends up to Orlando, and the upper Kissimmee Basin has got a lot of expanding urban activities in the Orlando area, the I-4 corridor and all the tourism and expansion of urban areas in that area is one of the major sources of phosphorus actually coming into Lake Okeechobee. And as you move down that basin, you go through cattle farms and dairy farms, other human activities that are also generating nutrients. And of course, all these nutrients from expanding human activities, both nitrogen and phosphorus, are coming into the lake. And as a result of all that heavy rain and nutrient loading, the lake was poised in the spring with warming temperatures and increasing light for a bloom. And that's where the bloom began in around May, as we again had a lot of heavy rainfall in May. That's when we began to see the bloom expand in Lake Okeechobee.
You're listening to scientists Brian LaPointe with the Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute and Vince Lufko with Moat Marine Lab.
Dr. Lufko,
yes.
I understand Moat does a lot with technology and monitoring and sort of can sense when there is a red tide bloom coming. What's the natural cycle? How natural is this and how common it is? And what research are you guys embarking on right now?
Well, first of all, I'm going to back up a little bit just so, when I said before that, there's the harmful algal blooms, as the more general term, are caused by many different organisms that they're very different, So I just want to make sure that we're not, we don't lump everything together and call all the algae the same, because what's happened, in the St. Lucie estuary and also to some degree in the Caloosahatchee from the Okeechobee releases is it's not the same thing that affects Florida red tide or the Karenia brevis. So with that as a background, we do a lot of work for Florida red tide. Our group here at Moat Marine Lab, we do a lot of monitoring and research for the state, for Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. And we have a partnership with them, and we do a lot of the monitoring and also some of the research related to red tide, trying to identify the triggers and the causes of red tide, as well as some of the potential ways to control red tide, mitigation efforts, some of the effects on shellfish or the toxin retention in shellfish. So as far as your other question about what is the progression, how do we understand our collective groups, you know, there's a lot of different groups, not just MOAT, it's MOAT and Fish and Wildlife and some of the other organizations around the area. And we all partner together often, you know, sharing data and sharing information. You know, some of the information that we've figured out in the past few years is that Karenia brevis, now we're talking about the Florida red tide, actually initiates offshore. We're not quite sure exactly where, but, you know, 40, 50 miles offshore near the bottom is what the current understanding is. And feeding off of different nutrients than some of the other phytoplankton can feed off of. In fact, that dynamics of the hydrodynamics that are occurring on the shelf, that is the movement of water, you know, from very deep and also shallow along the shelf, and the different nutrients that brings and the different nutrients that might be present, influence whether or not we have or can influence whether or not we have a red tide any given year. And except for early on this year, we have not seen any evidence of Florida red on the West Florida shelf so far. Once a bloom does form, then that bloom is moved by currents, water currents that are moving along the bottom and bring that bloom towards the coast, and then they upwell near the shore. And that's when we often see the red water at the surface near the beaches that cause respiratory irritation in humans, and when we often see the dead fish washing up.
So many people listen to this program. They're policymakers, lobbyists, lawmakers. But what would you like them to know about red tide and the algal bloom and all of that stuff? What's important for them to take away as they listen to this, maybe turning policy out of this information? What should we know about these occurrences here in Florida?
Well, I'll start with a little bit about the blue-green algae blooms in Lake O and again, that's a freshwater organism. It's a cyanobacterium. And, you know, what's happening in Florida, we're beginning to see an impact throughout the state on many of our freshwaters. Our freshwater springs are seeing algae blooms unprecedented. A place like Wakulla Springs, just south of Tallahassee. I think a lot of people are familiar with what's happening at Wakulla. And I think if you extend that down to Lake Okeechobee, I think it's this summer is a bit of a wake-up call that our legislature really needs to think about legislation to begin to kind of moderate the nutrients that human activities are generating that are supporting these blooms. And we've got to congratulate the city of Tallahassee for taking steps to remove nitrogen from their effluent at their wastewater treatment plant. That was one of the sources of nitrogen feeding the algae blooms at Wakulla. But, you know, Florida is growing. Almost 1,000 people a day are moving here. And one of the things our research has identified is a really need for improved infrastructure in many, many parts of Florida. And the Indian River Lagoon is a prime example where we just have not maintained the needed infrastructure for wastewater in particular to keep the lagoon in a healthy state where it has a seagrass-based ecosystem. It's shifting more to a phytoplankton-based ecosystem now with these harmful algal blooms. And septic tanks are one of the sources we've identified of nutrients in the Indian River Lagoon, but also other wastewater treatment plants. And I think if we look north of Lake Okeechobee, we can certainly look at many areas where we really need to tighten up sources, you know, of nutrients that are coming down into the lake and causing the problems that we've been seeing this past year.
All right. Dr. Lufko?
I think in a broad sense, but also specifically to Florida red tide, the Karenia brevis issue on the West Florida coast, but I think Brian would agree with this in general, is that we can't just be reactionary. We can't wait till there's a problem and then go out and study it. If you study a bloom, say a red tide or a cyanobacterial bloom, when the bloom's already underway, you've already missed the conditions that lead to that bloom. So especially when it comes to Florida red tide, I mean, we have to monitor year round, and we do. And oftentimes when there hasn't been a bloom for a while, the issue kind of takes a back seat. And I think the the potential problems that it causes also take a back seat. And people forget that it's still an issue and that we have to be out there because we have to collect this data in order to understand why these blooms form. Now, I think I'll let Brian speak to it more if he likes to, but I think the causes of the cyanobacterial blooms are pretty clear. They're nutrients. The causes of red tide are much more dynamic. Red tide has been here for a very long time, and the different nutrient sources and the different factors such as the currents and the time of year and temperature and a lot of other parameters all come together to create a red tide, and we don't fully understand them all yet. And so that research has to continue.
So if I'm getting you correctly, red tide is more natural, the algal bloom is more man-made, common effects?
Well, they're all natural organisms that are present. They take advantage of the conditions that they find themselves in. And in the case of cyanobacteria, if they get a large blast of nutrients, they're going to bloom when they wouldn't normally. In the case of red tide, it seems to have these cycles that are somewhat seasonal, although red tide can form blooms at any time of the year, that are obviously related to nutrients because these are photosynthesizers, and like plants, they have to have nutrients and sunlight in order to grow and bloom. But those nutrient sources are very diverse and varied. And as I mentioned, we currently believe that the red tide initiates offshore near the bottom. So that's more or less outside of the reach of anthropogenic or human-derived nutrients. It's at least for that initiation, it's a natural source of nutrients. Certainly, as the blooms get closer to shore, they can be fueled by anthropogenic nutrients, but that's still a question that has not been fully resolved.
Yeah, I can add actually to that, Vincent. In 2004, 2005, We were working down in Lee County initially on the red drift algae, the seaweed blooms. But if you remember, 2005 was a very wet year. I think that was the hurricane year. We had four hurricanes that crossed Florida that year and record rainfall, a lot of runoff. And what we saw actually all around the Gulf, not just on the Southwest Florida shelf, were red tides. And so our study kind of switched from red drift algae blooms to looking at the red tides off Lee County. And we got to sample some of the red tides and use some of the same scientific techniques we use to study the nutrient source, which is nitrogen isotopes, okay, to see, for example, if this is natural nitrogen fixation, like offshore, as Vincent was explaining, that are fueling these blooms. But these blooms we studied were relatively close to shore, within several miles off Sanibel. And they were in low salinity water, 30 parts per thousand salinity. This is river discharge water with high nutrients. And the isotope values in the blooms in that location did match up with kind of a strong wastewater signal that we also measured coming out of the Caloosahatchee River. Okay, now that doesn't necessarily mean all human wastewater. That can be cattle. That can actually come from a number of different organisms. But it's the data I've seen for the blooms offshore or the red tide offshore is much, much lower isotope value, meaning that these blooms do switch their nutrient sources depending on where they are.
So we're using nutrients, this word nutrients, and it, to me, in my kitchen, nutrients, it sounds really, it's something that we want, and it's good. Like, how do we distinguish nutrients? Are nutrients a bad thing out there in the water?
It's called too much of a good thing.
Ah.
Indeed.
It's too much of a good thing.
So nutrients, and that's what's fueling it. You mentioned cattle. How much is agribusiness impacting what we're seeing?
Well, the South Florida Water Management District has been studying nutrient sources north of Lake Okeechobee for decades, and they have a lot of data, and they've been working with the farmers, and they've made great strides in cleaning up, for example, the dairy farms that were a major source of phosphorus input to Lake Okeechobee from the north. So they've done a lot. And obviously, the farms are contributing. But once again, if you look at the data, and I recently was reviewing it, it looks like about a large fraction, 25% of the water and phosphorus is coming from urban areas up on the upper Kissimmee Basin in the Lake Okeechobee. I think that's maybe the largest single source coming into the lake. And again, if you're looking, you know, at where do we begin to try to clean all these nutrient sources up, given Florida's growth rate right now, you know, with the projected numbers of people that are coming here, it appears that our population growth and wastewater generated by that could be one of the fastest growing nutrient sources in Florida. And this brings me back to my previous point that we really need to think about improving our infrastructure, particularly wastewater, for controlling that particular source of nutrient. Because as you look at the data, more and more we're seeing that there's a much bigger urban factor than we realized, even in places like Lake Okeechobee, where we've generally pointed, you know, fingers at farmers, mm-hmm. at cattle farmers or dairy farmers or sugar farmers, and that we really need to, again, use the science to guide the policies to get at the nutrients.
All right. Well, thank you both, Dr. Lefko, Dr. Lapointe, for taking this time to speak with me here on the Rotunda. I really appreciate it.
I'm happy to do it.
Thanks, Trimmel.
That's it for this edition of the Rotunda. Special thanks to Tia Mitchell with the Times Union, Dr. Brian Lapointe with Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute, and Dr. Vince Lefko with Moat Marine Lab. Remember to visit rotundapodcast.com and join us again next week right here for more stories about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Trimmel Gomes.